Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the birth of outlaw country music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Of all the groundbreaking musicians to come out of the 60s, few were as engaged socially and politically as Joan Baez. A lifelong proponent of nonviolent activism, Joan marched with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and has continued to advocate for nonviolent civil disobedience ever since. With the release of her debut album in 1960, Joan Baez became the preeminent female folky. With just her exquisite soprano and her guitar, she reworked classic American folk songs and eventually wrote songs that helped fuel her activism. By the time she helped launch Bob Dylan's career by inviting him on stage with her in the early 60s, Joan was already an international sensation. In 2019, after a career that spanned nearly six decades, Joan announced she was no longer performing live. In recent years, she's turned her creative attention to visual art. Her new book of drawings titled Am I Pretty When I Fly features sketches rooted in humor, freedom, and sorrow. But in classic Joan Baez style, of course, her drawings defy convention. They were all drawn upside down. On today's episode, you'll hear a live conversation I had with Joan Baez at the Chicago Humanities Festival in May. Joan spoke about the emotional catharsis she finds in drawing. She also talked about juggling music and activism as a young artist, and what happened when she handed over access to her personal storage unit to a group of documentary filmmakers. Also, despite giving up live performance, she took a moment to serenade the crowd, all with her beautiful, beloved voice. This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond. Here's my conversation with the great Joan Baez.
Thank you so much for making this wonderful book of your drawings. They're amazing, and I can't wait to get into a lot of them. But before we get into that, it's amazing. We're both from California. We both flew here to Chicago to do this. And it feels very apt because in a lot of ways, this is kind of where you started it in show business, right? Kind
of. Well, certainly this atmosphere of folk music, folk folks. And it was mine was mainly in Cambridge. And people associate me with the village, but I was only there a couple of times. It was mainly Cambridge and the folk scene there, yeah.
Well, which is where you would have gotten into music, but then the Gate of Horn here in Chicago really feels like Albert Grossman's club.
Oh my God, that was a big deal for me because I was 18 or 19 and I was scared to death. And also I was afraid that if I sang somewhere where they were selling booze, I would go to hell. I mean, literally, That's where I was at that point in my life. And I heard Albert Grossman trying to convince my parents that I should come and sing at the Gate of Horn. And I heard one of them say, oh, she'll never do it. She's too scared. So immediately I said, okay, I'm going. Yeah. And I did, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks or something like that. I opened for Bob Gibson at the Gate of Horn.
Legendary place, and a young Roger McGuinn was lurking around, and who was born and raised here. And I can't imagine what that must have looked like. That also led to you performing at the inaugural Newport Folk Festival, right?
It was the first one. Up until then, it had been jazz festival, just a jazz festival. And like the little club where I sang, Club 47 in Cambridge, it had been a jazz club for years. These two women ran it. And then they saw the writing on the wall, and they started putting folk music in. And I was the first artist, and I got paid $10 a night. I was rich, broad, you know. And then pretty soon it was two nights a week and $15 a night. And my family says I would come home with this money and I'd throw it over. We had a balcony and I'd hurl it over the balcony. I thought everybody would like that so much and they all hated me for it.
What was your parents? Your parents didn't think you would actually settle into this lifestyle or to this career but what was their impression of you actually sort of starting to become an actual, a working musician?
I have to give my father credit. He didn't like the whole folk music idea for me. Same as, you know, talk about your family. They want to make sure you're on the straight and narrow and going to make money or get married or whatever's appropriate. But after, he was the one who took me into Harvard Square. It took the way he had three daughters and his wife into Harvard Square because he'd seen this phenomenon of folk clubs. And they were filled with smoke and Harvard students playing chess and reading and, you know, being very academic and philosophical and cool. And I saw a young man playing, I think it was guitar or some stringed instrument under this yellow light, and he was singing Plaisir d'amour. And it was over for me. I mean, that's all I was interested in ever after that was being there. Got myself a guitar, copied everybody, stole everything they ever did. And my mother was my greatest fan. I mean, if I'd stayed in the crib and just played with beads the rest of my life, she would have the best bead player you ever know. But my dad realized that this was something real and he appreciated it.
Wow. I was surprised going through the book because it seems to me you've lived a relatively, a very charmed life. And I was surprised to see the amount of under the heading of innocence and early in the book, the amount of sort of angst that comes from your drawing of children.
You know, I was a Mexican down near the border in Southern California, which is where, you know, an image like middle school would come from. And so I was an outsider, you know, and our family moved all the time. So it was a new school. I was the outsider. There's a picture in there of a little girl at the door, a teacher saying, who wants to sit next to Juanita? Well, nobody's going to want to sit next to Juanita. It was a terrible way to say it. And so, I mean, I appear to myself in these drawings a lot. I didn't know that ahead of time because I don't know what's going to come out on that page when I start drawing, but I see me in a lot of it. And we were marginal, our family. My father's born in Mexico. And I look Mexican, my sisters didn't, so they didn't have as much trouble. But that's where that feeling marginal came from.
It appears the way you think about children, maybe more largely, if not just your own childhood, is that there's this interaction with adults that is, there's a tense interaction, if anything.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. Kids trying to communicate with anybody, and certainly with their parents, and that division. And, you know, and a good parent keeps trying to find a way to their kid, often by listening, but we're all such bad listeners, you know. That's really what the kid wants. And the little kid there is basically saying, Mom, you know, yoo-hoo, I exist, I'm here. And Mom's busy hanging out the laundry, and she's not paying any attention at all. No, that is not my mom.
I know you don't know exactly where these come from, but maybe we can start with all of the drawings in the book come from drawing upside down. How did that start?
I'm thinking that it started, we were talking about me finding refuge for myself from whatever was bothering me. And whatever happened in the process of a combination of that and really not being bored with school. I mean, I was afraid, yeah, but I was also just bored stiff. And so I started writing with my left hand. Well, that was interesting. And then I started drawing backwards. That was interesting. I wrote the entire Greek alphabet backwards and, you know, now memorized it backwards. If that gives you any idea of how important that math class was to me, that's how important it was to me. And then I just look at it as a sort of a graduation when I moved into drawing upside down and putting the labels. And the process is not difficult. It's just confusing. If I'm sitting here and I'm drawing, you're seeing it right side up, I'm seeing it upside down. Often I don't know what it's going to be at all. I just start making these lines around the page and then it begins to develop. And sometimes I think, oh, I get it. That's a guy and that's a dog. And then it will develop from there. And then I'll turn it back, I'll look at it and see if there's something to fill in with and or a phrase will come to my mind. That's the magic of it. That I might have even started with one idea, but when I turn it around, I say, ah, that's not what it's saying to me. It's saying something different. And then I turn it back and I write it upside down. I write that way.
When you add the phrase to the drawings, at that point, are you analyzing where this might have come from within you, or is it really then also just looking at it almost as if anyone could have drawn it and seen what it...
That's nice, yeah. You know, I just... don't analyze, period, any of this stuff. I'm sure I analyze some things, but it would kind of, in my opinion, probably ruin it a little if I knew exactly, you know, the dynamics of, Stephen Colbert said, oh, do you stand on your head to do these drawings? I said, sort of picture me dangling off a jungle gym doing the drawings upside down.
Do you find yourself revising any of the writings that you put above it, any of the...
Oh, good question. Once it's written down, I can't because it's in ink. Sometimes I look at it and I think, oh, it should have said, you know, but it's written so I can't change it.
I'm sure we could find a way for you to do that and preserve the integrity of the drawing. But that would be less fun, I guess. When do you find yourself drawing upside down versus right side up? Is there a reason that you draw upside down? Like, is it when you feel stuck or...
No, it's just fun. But I draw right side up as well. You know, mostly little sketch little things. And then I drew when I was in junior high and high school. And I drew my boyfriends. And I drew James Dean. And I charged $5 for the drawings. But if we go back way far, and this is in the introduction to the book, but I would draw Bambi and Thumper from my little porcelain guys, you know, and then I would charge 3 pennies for each one. And that little place where you put your pencil inside the wooden desk, yeah, I would have pennies in it.
That's amazing. In terms of the creativity that goes into your drawings, or the way you approach it, the sort of non-analyzing, the wanting to sort of do it upside down to ensure that it's coming from like a real sort of subconscious place, was that also the case with your music?
In the way that it came naturally and untrained, then it's very much the same. I mean, following that guy I saw in the coffee shop, it was just my life. You know, I mean, I would fall asleep playing the guitar. The guitar's on my chest, and I would wake up and I'd go on playing. You know, I didn't even move. It was just, it was all I did. I was immersed. And then I get in a project, and I was pretty much immersed in this project while we were working on it. You know, I didn't really think about much else. Just wanted to put these drawings in the right place and categorize them and put them in a book.
The drawings that are in the book, when did these happen? Are these older drawings, newer?
They went from maybe 10 or 12 years ago up until now. And that's how come I'd find them in these little bunches around the house. And I have found more since the book. You know, if I little stash with a rubber band about, I think, oh, goody, you know, it's some other insanity. And it is.
Do you find catharsis in the emotion of the drawings, or do you find emotion, I guess, in the...
Yeah, you know, sometimes I've cried. the ones of the animals, you know, and that old horse is being pushed along, and the guy is saying, you know, come on, life is long, but you're, you know, he's empathetic with the horse, and the horse looks tired. And for me, it brings up, you know, every awful movie that's had horses hurt in it. So I get very moved by this stuff, but I can't pretend that it's myself who invented it. It's coming from somewhere else, so I can say that this is how it made me feel, or, you know, happy or sad or deep. Or
do you cry often, would you say? Just in life, are you a crier?
Oh, not particularly. I probably was when I was younger. Yeah.
So there is something about the quiet moments of turning a piece of paper upside down and...
Doesn't everybody?
No.
You know, my father is a scientist, very academic, you know, professorial, and he couldn't figure this out. He said, but I don't understand. And I said, you probably shouldn't try. He said, but what are you doing and how does that work? You know, I said, Papa, just, you know, try it. Try it. I took him one time to one of those places where you paint the pottery, do your own. He reluctantly came with me. I said, come on, you do one of these. Oh, I don't know how. I said, you don't have to know how. You know, he got a nice big bowl like that, got a bunch of colors. And he was going like, he said, oh, I hate it. Oh, it's awful. This looks horrible. I said, Pops, it's wonderful. But he couldn't explain it. So it was he was having a hard time with it.
Was he sort of the odd person out in the family? It feels, I mean, you and your sister clearly had an artistic sensibility. Seems like your mother.
Poor guy, yeah. I mean, he has three daughters and a wife who had no left brain, nothing there, nothing, not even a little P-shaped thing. And he, I mean, father was passionate about standing waves. And he would talk about it all the time. We didn't know what he was talking about. And a bunch of family went to one of his speeches, and he thought, you know, support him. And he started talking about standing waves. He says, can anybody here tell me what a standing wave is? And my aunt got up and went like this. If that explains anything.
To this day, do we know what standing waves are?
No, not really.
Guess I'll look that one up. I would love to go to the image, I think it's image 5.
She's pregnant. Mm. And he is not the dad who got her pregnant. He's trying to say, don't worry, honey, I understand. Let me tell your mom, which might mean we're not going to say anything and I'll protect you from that. Or it means let me break that to your mom. I think that's what that's about. And it's just very, it's very emotional.
These works are highly emotional.
That you call them works. I love that. Sounds so official, doesn't it? Piece, and these are my works.
You're Joan Baez. It does sound, I mean, your life is a work. I mean, your existence is.
And it wasn't this stuff, though. It was your works. I love that.
You're very self-deprecating. I can appreciate that about you. I was reading something about your documentary, and in it you say that the only great song you wrote, not in the documentary, but in this little piece about the documentary, you tell the interviewer, the only great song you ever wrote was Diamonds and Rust, which it's a great song, but that's not true. It is a great song, but that's not true. You know, I mean,
thank you.
David's song.
That only means that I think only one of my songs has a universality, that it just catches in a different way and it's bigger than itself. No, I think I've written a lot of good songs, but I do think that one's head and shoulders above the ones under it. What do I know?
And that has to do with how you perceive people interact with the song.
I guess probably you're right, yeah.
Yeah. But those other songs, I mean, you've written so many gorgeous songs.
Thank you.
I really, I almost wish you had written more gorgeous songs or more songs in general that would then be gorgeous, you know?
They picked the right guy.
Hard questions are coming. I'm just buttering you up, okay? But your documentary, I'm just wondering about this period of your life post-touring. You've wrapped up that part of your life, which was many decades long.
You were barely a spark in your mother's eyes.
Neither of my parents were born when this part of your life began. So. Now she's not going to like me. Go back to buttering you up. This part of your life, though, post-touring, where has it left you with processing both your life, the things that have happened? And there's a documentary that you made with some friends that will be coming out that sounds incredibly personal.
It is. It is. And I sort of figure out I haven't got anything to lose. Really, seriously. And my family is all gone. Anybody who could have been hurt or confused or whatever, I didn't do that while they were alive. And it's very personal. And the women who directed it, one of them is a very close friend. And that's why it was possible. Because I just held my nose and took a deep dive and said, because I wouldn't have control. They would have control. So I had to have that faith. And the film was about the last tour. That's kind of the theme of it, the last tour. And then I cut them loose in my storage unit. I'd never been in the storage unit. I thought storage units had things like old lamps, you know? And this thing had a lifelong thing of tapes of stuff that I was 22, and I would speak and send it to my parents in place of a letter and write letters. And here's me at 22 saying, "Oh, mommy, I'm so excited because tomorrow I get to meet Dr. Martin Luther King and we'll sing at the so-and-so Baptist church." So here's this kid. So we don't have me explaining what it was like. We have, you know, voice of me then. Yeah.
There's also, you've been open in the past about going to therapy. But included, I've not seen it, but as I understand, included, there's also you've recorded, in the past, you've recorded some of your therapy sessions, yeah. And some of those tapes are in there.
Yeah, those are kind of scary. But, I mean, yeah. I didn't see this stuff till it's done. That's what they do. They say, "Oh, we'll let you see towards the end." So 2 days before it's towards the end, you look and they say, "Ah!" And there's nothing I can do. So it was really just faith.
You didn't sift through any of that with them?
Mm-mm.
Have you, since it was screened for you, have you
had any second thoughts?
Yes.
It's too late. There are a couple of things I thought, I wish they hadn't put that in. But, you know, I can see that it adds to the quality of the film.
We'll be back with more of my conversation with Joan Baez in just a sec.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution?
through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with my conversation with Joan Baez.
You mentioned Dr. King earlier. When did you first meet Dr. King?
You know, I don't remember the first actual meeting. I remember when I saw him, which was a life-changing event. And I was a gathering of high school students put on by the American Friends Service Committee. And they were from all over the country. And we would discuss politics and nonviolence. And that, and each year they would do this and they'd have a speaker. And the year I went, so I was 16, it was Dr. King. And he was talking about, I can't even say it, I'm getting teary. He was talking about the bus boycott. And I started to cry and I couldn't stop because he was doing what we've been talking about and studying. And there was this guy, was 29 or something? 26, if I was 16, he was 26. And he was just doing and engaged and with people and taking the risks. The risk is always, to me, it's the point at which there will be no social change worth talking about until some people are willing to take a risk. That's easier said than done, you know. But that's when, I mean, they were taking the risk, every single one of those folk, you know, including Dr. King.
As you move on into your career, and I mean, obviously, I've always wondered, did your activism feel separate from your music, or did your music compel your activism?
Both. When I was 13, I had a ukulele, and I started to play. And what I remember learning with that ukulele was a lot of different songs, a lot of rhythm and blues, because that's what I loved, and they had only four chords, max. And then I learned Emmett Till, and I realized that how connected I was to that. I mean, my parents are Quakers, so that's pacifism, nonviolence, activism. And so the dots began to connect. And then when I was 15, I stayed in school during when you're supposed to duck and cover, and the Russians are going to send a missile over. Well, that's not so out of the question now. It was going to blow up my high school. I thought, this is so dumb. You know, and the kids are doing it. They're going to go home, and the siren goes off. They're going to run home, or they're going to have bomb parties in their swimming pools. And I thought, I'm going to stay in school to just resist it. And so I did. And that was purely political. That had no music, you know, involved with it at that moment. So that age, I was really waking up to activism.
This is why Dr. King felt like such a revelation. Sorry, now I'm going back, but your parents are Quakers. And then you're seeing Dr. King, who essentially was schooled in nonviolent activism from Bayard Rustin, who was a Quaker. So, of course, that must have really, really resonated.
Yeah, it all resonated. Bayard was an extraordinary man, you know, behind the scenes, because he was so sensitive. They didn't want his homosexuality to ruin anything in the public perception of the movement. And the guy was just a massive force behind Dr. King and behind all of us.
Really, I don't think any of that would have happened without Bayard.
Yeah.
His philosophies underpinned almost all of that work. Dr. King, Ralph Abernathy, all of them were doing.
Yeah.
How was it toggling between the glamour, you could say, of music and you know, and you're in two worlds. You're dealing with luminaries in music. You're dealing with luminaries in sort of public life. And how would you toggle between those two things?
You know, I kind of didn't. My battle was with not wanting to be commercial, you know, and I thought that was, well, we're going back to I'd Go to Hell, you know, if I sang at a place that had booze in it, that going, you know, becoming commercial was a really, really bad thing for me. And I don't know where I drew that line, but I mean, for instance, the stage had to be black with nothing on it, no flowers, no flags, no. And I thought, well, this is really simple for people. They said I was impossible because they set up these great sets on TV and I say, strike everything. Get all here, you know, I'm Miss Perfectly Folk, whatever. And really afraid to veer from that, that I was doing something really bad.
Almost like the way a gospel artist might have thought, or like a Ray Charles might have thought about secular music versus gospel.
Yeah. No, it's very similar to that.
That level of dedication to like a higher cause.
And that level of silliness. I mean, you know, I didn't know that at the time, but I overdid it at every turn, you know. I remember one time I decided no more limousines for me. This is not right. It's not what everybody does. They have normal cars. So I stuck to that for about 2 weeks. And then somebody picked me up in this battered old Volkswagen bus, and it was so uncomfortable. I thought, oh, screw it. You know, bring on the limousines and the red carpet.
Don't blame you. So yesterday, I landed, found out Tina Turner passed away, and I was just curious if, like, when or how or if you guys had crossed paths.
I have my great Tina stories. When my career was tanking, she was just coming back up for her second round, you know, as a lioness. And she, yeah. And so I met her in Germany, and they were celebrating her and her success. And somebody asked her how she felt about all this. She said, I'm just so happy to be rid of Ike. I don't care about the rest. Just like... And then, you know, she was really sweet with me. She realized that I was in a pickle, you know. And she came over and she said, I said, what should I do? She said, girlfriend, get a wig. First of all, y'all need a wig. I said, oh, good, is that all I need, you know? And then we were on the same TV show together. And I saw her performance. She performed Steel Claw. You ever hear that song? It is as ferocious and evil, and she's perfect for it. And she came off the stage and I said, Tina, your mother mated with a scorpion. And I meant it as a compliment and she took it as a compliment.
That is the most accurate description of a Tina Turner performance I have ever heard. Was that TV show? Was it? I didn't realize that there was a sequel to the Tammy show in 66, the Big TNT show.
Oh my God, yeah.
And you performed on that with Ike and Tina, with Tina.
And
was it that show?
No. This is years later, when she and I were on tour in different parts of Germany. Yeah, and I had one night at the Olympia, and she had 2 weeks booked there to rehearse. Said, "Oh boy, I got a long way to go." You know?
I see why you went to her for advice. Makes a lot of sense. Also, yesterday, Bill Lee passed, who, understandably, Tina Turner is incredible and just deserves everything. But Bill Lee, really integral, it seemed, to the early folk scene that you guys were part of. This was Spike Lee's father.
He was the bass player. The first or second time, I don't remember, I went to Newport. Odetta and her husband, Danny, was that his name? They drove me. And Bill Lee was her bass player. And so I was in good hands, yeah.
He's such a great bass player.
Yeah.
Toggle between jazz and folk kind of seamlessly. Beautiful. Back to my original point. You're hanging with Tina Turner. You're hanging with Bayard Rustin and Dr. King. I shouldn't say hanging. I should say that you're working with these people. And I imagine to some degree, your career might have probably suffered to some degree, or not suffered, but I imagine you probably could have, if you had taken the advice of Albert Grossman and signed to Columbia and maybe just...
Yeah, they were so sure. I mean, the Grossmans and the people at Columbia were so sure that I would go with Columbia because that had Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary, Janis Joplin, and we were just collecting them like that. So that was the place to go. And because of all these things about going to hell and going commercial, I chose Vanguard Record Company, which is basically a classical music record company. And it was perfect. I was with them for a long time. Very, you know, had a real sense about the folk music, did a lot of choosing songs with me, and really got into it in a way that I know Columbia would not have done, or I think they would not have done. Mm.
We should pull up image one, if you can pull that up. You wrote this beautiful Deo Deo, Harry Belafonte. Daylight coming, we want to go home. Harry. Similarly,
I sent that to his wife.
Did you?
Yeah, she was so happy. Yeah.
Did you get a response? He saw it?
Oh yeah. Well, no, he didn't. It was just after he died.
Just after he passed.
We saw him a couple of times in his mid-90s, and he was just. When my son was with me and another friend, and when we left talking with Harry, my son burst into tears. He said, "I feel like I've been in the presence of a fucking prophet." And I said, "Well, that's because you have been, you know." But this is slightly divorced from that. But okay, so when I'm drawing that, there's this girl, and I see she's got a flower pot. I thought it was a flower pot, or a little basket, you know, where the flower's coming out. And so I turn it around, and I see there are palm trees sticking out. And so, okay, I'll turn it back. Now I know there are palm trees. I'll stick something in. There's this little elf kind of dancing. Turn it back over, and he's kicking her in the side. And so she's saying, "Deo Deo," and that's from the palm trees, right? And then that's just my sidekick. And that's what came out.
It's so whimsical. I love it. Was Harry's calypso music, was that at all in your part of your sphere of influence?
Yeah, absolutely. I had not even heard Odette. I hadn't heard anybody, really. It was rhythm and blues. And my mom brought home this album of Harry Belafonte. We just stared at it. Nobody should look like that. He was
gorgeous,
so,
man.
He was so handsome. I don't know if we played it for the first 2 weeks. We just stared at it. I remember my father being a little unnerved by that. He was like, and then, yeah, and then I played it. And it was kind of, I don't think it, nobody got printed or not, but this first album I did, one half of the songs were Belafonte songs that I had taken. Yeah, I took them right directly off that album.
Wow. How was he thought of in the folk scene? Was he thought of in that? I mean, because he was taking old songs and, you know.
Yeah,
but
in the early snooty folk days, he was off limits because he was, you know, banging on drums and having a good time.
A little too rhythmic.
Which you weren't supposed to do, you know. And then, you know, and I didn't know, of course, none of us knew at that point that he was going to end up being political activist and working with Dr. King. But what a lovely way to arrive, you know.
Yeah.
After this last ad break, we'll be back with the rest of my conversation with the great Joan Baez live from Chicago. And now the rest of my conversation with Joan Baez.
Speaking of the early snooty folk days, as a person who was barely, a gleam in my parents' eyes when you started your career, I came to folk music relatively late, and I came through the Kingston Trio, who I love, and I was dismayed to find out.
I love them too.
Not cool. You did.
I had to hide them at the back of the record collection.
Really?
Yeah, because you're not, I mean, they were way too commercial.
You had Kingston Trio records.
I loved them. Yeah. But I couldn't let anybody know. I mean, my snooty folks saying, "No, ma'am." No.
I feel vindicated. I love them.
I feel vindicated.
Great. I couldn't hide them on my iPod in the day. So, you know, I just took them off because I didn't want to be
guilty. Guilty pleasure.
Yeah. Replaced it with a Latter-day Dylan record or something to, you know, atone for my sins. Can we go to the next image? I think it's image, make sure I got my images right. There we go. Yeah, this one.
That's very Sophie's Choice looking to me. They made me choose, so I'm assuming, I'm thinking between her two kids, or three kids, they made her choose which one she was going to be able to keep. Mm. That's my guess. And you?
My guess was much lamer than that. She kind of looked like Joni Mitchell to me. I tried to warn you. I didn't want to tell you.
She's checking which label, which record label to go on. They may
well,
be shooting.
I didn't know. Well, you know, I didn't know. I mean,
she's saying Columbia or Vanguard.
No, not quite what I would. You know, no. So I'm not. I thought, okay, well, it looks like Joni Mitchell. Maybe was she? Did she feel like she was being? Did she ever feel like she was being pitted against other women in the industry? Or
that is so wild. I mean, to have an idea what people go through looking at this stuff, you know. In a billion years, I wouldn't have thought that was Joni Mitchell searching for a record company.
Someone else want to give an interpretation? Where, if we go back to the genesis of this, where would you have started?
That oval means it's a head.
So you'd start with the oval.
I think so, usually, yeah. And then an ear or two.
So by the time you do an oval, though, you know,
yeah.
Oh, okay, it's probably a face.
Yep. So.
So then you go to ears.
And I go to ears. I go to some weird hair thing. The eyes, a lot of the eyes are very similar, except they're looking in different places, you know. And so a lot of what's written on there will be determined by what their eyes are doing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
When did you add the tears?
Had what? The tears?
Yeah.
Probably early on to give it some character, whatever it was going to be. It would make it, you know, it would have some definition to it.
And when did you decide?
That it wasn't Joni Mitchell?
Yeah. At what point did you decide?
Odetta? No, it was not Odetta.
Yeah,
no.
That was my other guess. Maybe it was Odetta. Yeah. So, yeah. Why the color? Why the color on the scarf?
Oh, I don't know. Each of them has a little bit of color. I just got carried away and started adding a little bit of color to each of these things. If I did too much red, then I'd skip over to, that looks like orange and purple. But you know what I'm thinking is, one of my mother's stepmothers was really horrible, and her favorite colors were orange and purple. So who knows?
Oh. You know? That's interesting. Why was she so...
Awful. She's a schizophrenic lunatic. And she was very abusive to my mother and my mother's sister. My mother's sister, the one who did the standing waves. Yes, yeah, so yeah. She pulled through okay.
good. Would your mother talk to you about those sorts of things?
She did. We'd push her a little bit. I guess she watched a lot of the abuse. And so it's maybe even harder, they say, if you're just a... seeing this stuff, you don't have something to grab onto to try and change or heal.
Yeah.
My mother discovered antidepressants when she was in her 70s and when she realized she'd been depressed her whole life. She said, oh, she's saying things like, I didn't realize there were peppers growing on that pepper tree.
I had a similar experience with antidepressants. Similar experience also when I finally got eyeglasses too. I was like, wow. I remember seeing things, you know. Wow, I remember being happy. Wow, this is great. You know, thank God for
antidepressants
and eyeglasses. Two things that have saved my life.
You had enough of Joni Mitchell?
No, had enough of Joni, you know. never mind.
You're scoring 100, so go ahead.
Okay. Did you... Well, because I thought that perhaps this could have been a choice. Like, did you ever feel in the industry in those days, a lot of women in the industry that I've spoken to still, I know they feel like they're pitted against one another. Almost like for a while, there could be like one black comedian. Like now it's just like, there can be one like woman rapper, you know? Like, did it feel like there could be, did that pressure to compete against women exist then?
You mean for me?
For you.
I didn't think I had anything to compete against. There was no competition in my, you know, weird little brain because I was so insecure in so many ways, but not about this voice, which also is a gift, and I can claim it as a gift.
Can we hear some of that voice? No, 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 no.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking. marching up to freedom land.
Amazing. Can't follow that. We should follow that with Q&A so you guys can try to follow that. Yeah, maybe we should we turn it over to the audience for some questions? We got some people out there with the microphones. If you want to ask a question, and again, a question, not a comment, I will remind you.
Not a story.
You.
Somebody gave me this t-shirt and said, please don't tell me your story. And I loved it. And then he commenced to tell me the whole story of how he bought it and where he found it.
Our first question will be up here.
Hi, Joan. Thank you so much for joining us. This is so cool. My question is, what do you do when you don't know what to do next?
Well, one of the things I do is I talk to this tree. There's a mighty oak tree in a field across from the house. And I don't see therapists anymore. But I will go and talk to this tree, and I will get an answer. And I either go to the tree and say, listen, can you help me understand this problem so I'll feel better? And sometimes I just say, I want to feel better. I don't care what the problem is. I don't want to learn. I just want to feel better. And if it's, what do I do next? That's where I would go, would be that tree. But generally, I don't have to ask the question.
It's a great question. Nice and succinct, too. Yeah, well, we have someone up here.
Hello. I've listened to Diamonds and Rust many times, and every time I listen to it, I say, if that's not Dylan you're talking about, but then in your book, you say, no, when Dylan called you, if I remember the book correctly, you denied it, and were you kidding him? I mean, how could that not be Dylan?
I don't understand how I denied it.
In your book, when you wrote about Diamonds and Rust in your book, you said that, at least if my memory serves, and at my age it may not, you said that when he called you to thank you about writing about him in Diamonds and Rust, you told him, no, that wasn't about you.
Okay, I got it now. First of all, he would never call and say anything about the song. So, we're up there. But I was joking with him, because at the beginning of Rolling Thunder, and he hadn't paid any attention, had no hello, no whatever, came directly over and said, hey, you gonna do that one about the guy with the blue eyes? I said, oh, you mean my husband? And he was not a happy camper. That's the story, though.
I have two questions. My first question is, do you have any communications whatsoever with Joni Mitchell?
Don't bring up Joni Mitchell.
Yeah, I know. And my second one is, what type of activism are you involved in today?
Okay, first of all, I never had a closeness with Joni. I've worked with her a couple of times, and I admire her enormously. And I was really happy to see her. Where was it, Newport? When she came? Yeah, I thought that was brilliant. What was the next question?
What do you do for activism currently?
Oh, what am I doing?
How do you activate? Your activism. How do I?
Well, first of all, I wrote the book. I mean, I'm thinking about that's probably more political than a number of things that I could have done. And if something comes along that I really think is appropriate for me to be out there with, then I'm sure I'll be out there. And I can, you know, I would suggest to other people that they go make good trouble because it makes their lives, you know, really worth something, I believe. What you got on?
That's my t-shirt. Good trouble.
Yay. Okay.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I got a question. Up here.
Up here?
Yeah. So that was an interesting story about the box with the, you know, tapes in it and so forth that the filmmakers got. And I think that many people have boxes like that in their attics and so forth with old things, you know, and so forth. So I guess I'm curious, how did you decide, like you decided to give it to them to deal with, and then you also said, if I understood right, that you're not going to look at that stuff ever again. Can you talk about how you made those decisions? That's quite profound. I can't wait to see the documentary. Thank you.
Thank you. I just meant that after this film is done and I've seen it all and stuff that I'd never seen before. I didn't know anybody had kept. I have no desire to revisit that and try to drag much more stuff out of those boxes. They think that's enough, though.
Will you destroy them?
You know, I don't know what I'm going to do with them. It probably is the time to have a glorious bonfire with a bunch of prayers stuck, you know, here and there in it.
You're right, guys.
And it's sacred to do. I mean, otherwise, this stuff, it's just a museum.
You don't need people going through it.
They don't want to hear that shit, I promise you.
I would like to ask you a question. I'm right here. I'm your sound engineer.
Oh,
okay.
I'm originally from Argentina, and I would like to ask you about if you see any differences or similarities in the activism in South America and in America.
I don't know how to answer that question, except that I think that some places you pay a heavier toll. You know, it's okay for me to sit here and talk about taking a risk. And in a country like Afghanistan or the Ukraine, taking a risk is a very different thing. And so in Latin America, it's somewhere in between. No. But the bravery it takes anywhere to make that final, you know, I'm just going to do this. I just have to do this. I mean, here it might be, okay, I'm going to go in a library and I pick out a banned book and I'm going to read it. Out on the street corner. I'm going to set up a microphone and a thing. I'm going to read the book, you know? Something like that. And where gays are not supposed to get married, you organize, you know, a huge wedding of as many people as you can get. And those are forms of nonviolent civil disobedience, which are invaluable and scary, and we got to do them anyhow.
Maybe a couple more.
Okay, I have a question. My question was, is our country doomed? And
yes.
Mm-hmm. And someone who has, you know, lived through the civil rights movement, what words of encouragement do you have for somebody like me who's really disheartened with the, you know, state of affairs in our country today?
Well, your question is an oxymoron. Do I have any hope? Not particularly. But the other day, somebody said, hope is a discipline. You know, I think that's because I don't consider myself a very hopeful person. I've managed to shift over from being a total pessimist to somebody considering hope, but it would be a practice. I mean, you have to practice it because this is not a hopeful world. This is not a hopeful country. This is heading towards, and parts of it already are, a fascist country. So what do we do? Actually, I made a list. I was sharing it with Justin because people say, what do I do? And I've always given this dumb stare. But now I've made a list of which I will post on my Instagram and or Facebook page, which with suggestions. I mean, from gun violence to the Ukraine to women's rights to, there are all these things somebody could get on different levels. You can donate, you can support, or you can at some point take a risk. Mm. No, all are valuable.
All right, last question.
My question is about women in Iran. And non-violence resistance. You know that they came non-violent on the street and they faced with a bullet in the eyes. Execution, and it's going on for past 2 weeks. 50 people have been executed only for being on the street. How do we have this answer? How we can deal with this violence, brutal violence that people around the world, is not just Iran, but Iran, I think, is on the one of the
yes,
top countries.
Yes, up on the top, yeah. All we know is that trying to deal with it with violence is even worse, that you can't crush the state. I'm not telling anybody what they're supposed to do. I'm just looking at historically what has been done and why we've arrived at this state where we looked at violence as the only answer. I wish I had an answer for you. I painted Masha among my mischief makers. And it's too overwhelming, the sorrow, to spend a lot of time thinking about these different places, certainly including Iran, way high on the list, as you said.
One last one. Happy one, I hope. What advice would you give to new singer-songwriters?
You a singer-songwriter? Yeah, okay. No, I wish I had something brilliant to say, except bravo and go make good trouble.
Thank you so much.
I want to thank Joan Baez for the live conversation we had from the Chicago Humanities Festival. Be sure to check out her new book, Am I Pretty When I Fly?, available mostly wherever books are sold. You can hear all of our favorite songs from the great Joan Baez on a playlist at BrokenRecordPodcast.com. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all of our new episodes. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Ben Tolliday, Nisha Venkat, Jordan McMillan, and Eric Sandler. Our editor is Sophie Crane. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription service that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for only $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like the show, remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com. Musora is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out. And then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.